This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
And I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, Trump's pick for education secretary played hooky when a group she helped finance and run was ordered to pay millions in fines for breaking Ohio election law. Looks like someone failed swamp draining 101.
And perhaps the craziest stuff happening this week isn't going down at Trump Tower amid visits from Kanye West and Leo DiCaprio. It's what's happening in North Carolina, where the state's GOP is taking extreme steps to disempower the incoming Democratic governor. Reporter Paul Bless joins us from on the ground in Raleigh with the story.
Plus more updates on tensions between the U.S. and China, sparked by Trump's questioning of a key foreign policy that has guided U.S.-China relations for the past few decades. We'll tell you all about that later in the show.
Yep, we're continuing to beat that China drum just like Trump is. But first, let's kick off the show with a classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
Wow, that was an aggressive move. Just
right off the top like that.
Classified session.
We rarely do that, but, you know, classified times call for classified measures. So it's really hard trying to just get a read on what exactly the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community really knows about the alleged interference in last month's presidential election by the Russian government. And that's not just how I, a regular old journo living here in Washington, D.C., it's not just how I feel. It's how the chairman of the freaking House Intelligence Committee feels as well. Republican Devin Nunes, he's the chair of the House Intel Committee, one of the bodies entrusted with conducting oversight of our spy agencies. He wants a briefing. He wrote a letter to the Director of National Intelligence on Monday calling for a briefing, not even an open briefing. He doesn't want this for the public. He just wants a closed briefing so that members of his committee can know what U.S. spies know about what Russia did in our election. But the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, isn't having any of it. He denied the committee's request. No briefing. So, the House Intelligence Committee can't even get a briefing on this. It's pretty tough here for the two Sams even to get a briefing. Little old Sams.
Clapper won't return my calls.
No. Nunes wasn't too pleased by Director Clapper's rejection. In a statement on Wednesday, Nunes said, "The committee is deeply concerned that intransigence in sharing intelligence with Congress can enable the manipulation of intelligence for political purposes." And then Nunes clarified why the hearing is necessary. Quote, "We want to clarify press reports that the CIA has a new assessment that it is not shared with us." That's what Nunes' statement coming out of the committee said. Now, this is important because intel agencies are saying completely different things today than what they said last time they appeared before the House Intelligence Committee. That happened last month in an open hearing. And Clapper, during that hearing, said that evidence connecting the government of Russia to WikiLeaks was, quote, not as strong, and that the intel community didn't have, quote, good insight into the sequencing of the releases. Now, as we all know, if you've been paying attention to the news over the last few days, since that briefing in November, the CIA has, like a sieve, been leaking claims to the contrary. Various news reports, relying on anonymous sources within the agency, have alleged that Moscow not only managed the hacks on the Democratic National Committee and Clinton campaign chair John Podesta, but that Moscow also directed the information to be turned over to WikiLeaks. And an NBC News report on Wednesday asserted that Vladimir Putin himself personally oversaw the operation. Reading from that report, U.S. intelligence officials now believe with a high level of confidence that Russian President Vladimir Putin became personally involved in the covert Russian campaign to interfere in the U.S. presidential election, senior U.S. intelligence officials told NBC News. Now, it's interesting, this story broke on Wednesday night. The author of that story appeared on MSNBC, where he was promptly asked, how would you know this? I mean, what sort of information are you working on? And the guy said, anonymous sources within the intelligence agencies. It is reports like these, which we've seen several of them, again, in recent days, several of them have come out, based on anonymous sources, that point to the existence of some sort of new CIA assessment that the public, nor most members of Congress, including those on committees of jurisdiction, have seen. There exists a secret CIA assessment that none of us have seen, including the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and it's an assessment that contradicts prior public assessments made by intelligence officials. I mean, that's the information we can glean from all of this. As Nunez noted in a letter to Clapper on Monday, in light of the committee's robust oversight efforts on these issues, I was dismayed that we did not learn earlier from you directly about the reported conflicting assessments and the CIA's reported revision of information previously conveyed to this committee. Now, to give both sides here, Intelligence Director Clapper has disputed these characterizations. His office released a statement Wednesday in response to Chairman Nunez, and Clapper noted that President Obama has called for a full intelligence review on the matter, and he also claimed that senior administration officials have regularly provided extensive, detailed, classified, and unclassified briefings to members and staff from both parties on Capitol Hill since this past summer and have continued to do so after Election Day. Of course, that doesn't really address the concerns of Chairman Nunez, who noted that, yes, we have received briefings after Election Day. On November 17th, I think, was that briefing in which Clapper said there wasn't good evidence connecting the Russian government to WikiLeaks. But there haven't been any briefings since then, and since then we've seen a new story emerging based on anonymous leaks out of the CIA. So if the guy charged with overseeing U.S. spies in Congress, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunez, hasn't been privy to these briefings, then you can guess that not many other lawmakers have either. And it's worth noting here that Nunez has a role on President-elect Donald Trump's transition team and thus has an interest in downplaying any allegations that his party's incoming president might have been aided in the election by a foreign power. But it's clear, even putting aside Nunez's charges, it's clear that Capitol Hill is clamoring for more information on the matter. Earlier this week, several Democratic senators, including Patrick Leahy, Ben Cardin, and Al Franken, wrote a letter to Clapper requesting a National Intelligence Estimate, an NIE, on Russian efforts to manipulate the recent U.S. presidential election. Now, NIEs are authoritative reports produced by the intelligence community on specific issues. We've seen previous NIEs on terrorist activities, NIEs on Iran's nuclear capabilities. And the senators stated in their letter that given the serious nature of these matters, with unprecedented national security implications, we believe that our intelligence community must prioritize a conclusive public NIE to lay out the facts of this serious matter for the American people. So clearly here we have senators who want more information, just like Chair Nunez. There's also a push by Democrats along with Senator Lindsey Graham to establish an independent congressional panel to investigate Russian interference in the election. Appearing on C-SPAN's Washington Journal Thursday morning, Senator Ben Cardin called for a joint inquiry similar to what was undertaken after the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks.
When we were attacked on 9/11, we set up an independent commission to find out what happened so we could protect ourselves and take appropriate action against those who would try to compromise our system. I think we need to do the same thing in regards to what Russia has done. Whether they attack us by a MiG or attack us by a mouse, it's an attack. And we need to have the information the public needs to know. And that's why I've called for an independent commission similar to what we did after the attack on 9/11.
Whether it's a MiG or a mouse, it's an attack, although there's a pretty big difference between the two, I'd say.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell shot down the idea of a special panel to investigate allegations against Russia. He admitted that the charges so far were disturbing, but that he'd leave it up to regular order. He'd leave it up to already established congressional committees to conduct any probes on the issue. Well, as we noted on yesterday's show, as soon as Congress gets done probing Russia's hack of the DNC and John Podesta and whatever else, maybe we can figure out who hacked Robbie Mook's brain, who programmed it to make the absolute worst decisions that led to Hillary Clinton missing an open layup against Donald Trump. Maybe we can get to answering that question. Okay, another story here for the good old classified session. Turns out that the Inspector General at the National Security Agency over the last few years was a real big prick. The Project on Government Oversight has learned that the NSA IG George Ellard is in the process of getting fired from his job for retaliating against government whistleblowers. I'm just going to read from Project on Government Oversight, or POGO. Reading from POGO's report, last May, after 8 months of inquiry and deliberation, a high-level intelligence community panel found that Ellard himself had previously retaliated against an NSA whistleblower. Informed of that finding, NSA Director Admiral Michael Rogers promptly issued Ellard a notice of proposed termination. Although Ellard apparently remains an agency employee while on administrative leave, pending a possible response to his appeal from Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. So it looks like we're going through the motions of firing the NSA's Inspector General. POGO's noting that this case proves that a new presidential directive, which aims to protect intelligence community whistleblowers, a directive known as PPD-19, is working.
Sounds like a bit of a hot take, and I had the exact opposite reaction about protections for whistleblowers when I first heard this story, but the fact that we've heard this story and the fact that something's being done about it does seem to indicate that policy-wise, something good has happened.
Yeah, here's what journalist Stephen Aftergood with the Federation of American Scientists said in response to the news, quote, "The finding against Ellard is extraordinary and unprecedented. This is the first real test drive for a new process of protecting intelligence whistleblowers. Until now, they've been at the mercy of their own agencies and dependent on the whims of their superiors. This process is supposed to provide them security and a procedural foothold." And of course, it's taken a while to get to this point. Ellard gained some notoriety over the last few years for attacking former NSA contractor turned whistleblower Edward Snowden. In 2014, Ellard claimed that, quote, "Snowden could have come to me." Ellard added that Snowden would have been given protection. And he said, quote, "We have surprising success in resolving the complaints that are brought to us. Perhaps it's the case that we could have shown, we could have explained to Mr. Snowden his misperceptions, his lack of understanding of what we do." Of course, Snowden did raise concerns with his superiors, as has been attested by several news outlets. But Snowden also noted that he didn't completely trust the NSA and its inspector general, and that he had seen the agency explicitly retaliate against previous whistleblowers just like him. And he named Thomas Drake. Drake, who tried to tell Congress and then informed a reporter about the NSA's domestic surveillance operations. Had his house raided, he had his security clearance revoked, his job taken away, he had his life savings sucked away because he was facing charges of under the Espionage Act. Basically had his life ruined for doing what was right, for blowing the whistle. You know, he had a job at the NSA, now he works at an Apple store as a result of all this. As POGO notes, in light of the news, now, given the official finding that Ellard retaliated against an NSA whistleblower, the credibility of Ellard's argument that Snowden could have come to him is gravely undermined.
Yeah.
Indeed it is. So, good riddance, Ellard. We'll see you around, assuming, I guess, that Secretary of Defense Ash Carter doesn't grant him an appeal to being terminated.
So this must mean that all the journalists, all the Washington journalists, all the Pentagon press corps who were saying that Snowden could have just, you know, told the inspector general or one of the inspectors general they must be all owning up to the fact that they were wrong about that.
Let me log on to Twitter here. I'm sure that there's just an endless stream of tweets from these people being like, oh, looks like I was wrong. I want to sincerely apologize to Mr. Edward Snowden. And I want to condemn the NSA Inspector General, Mr. Ellard, who should be fired. You know, we don't often advocate for people to lose their jobs on this show. We are against people losing their jobs, but an NSA Inspector General retaliating against whistleblowers, he needs to find a new line of work.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like he's really cut out for the gig.
No.
In Bizarro World, MSNBC hosts and Jeffrey Toobin are all falling over themselves to walk back their takes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to visit Bizarro World one day. Finally, one more story for the old classified session. After burying its head in the sand over mounting civilian casualties in Saudi Arabia's air war against Yemen, the U.S. is finally restricting some arms sales to the Gulf monarchy. According to the New York Times today, the White House has decided to block the sale of about 16,000 guided munitions kits produced by defense contractor Raytheon. It's going to cost Raytheon about $350 million. Pray for Raytheon, people. Pray for Raytheon.
Sorry, I was just so upset about Raytheon.
The Times noted that, quote, the administration officials said that upgrading the bombs would not help targeting if the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen did not choose its targets properly, an ongoing concern since the start of the bombing campaign.
What? Wait. Is it? No. An ongoing concern?
Well,
we've been supplying the Saudis with intelligence.
Not only have we been supplying the Saudis with intelligence, with billions of dollars in weapons.
Yeah.
And refueling missions.
Yes.
Yeah. The U.S. said it would stop selling cluster munitions to the Saudis for the same reasons, concerns over indiscriminate killing of civilians. You know, there was one point where the U.N. threatened to put Saudi Arabia on a list, countries that kill civilians, kill kids.
Kids, yeah.
Of course, the U.N. backed off after Saudi Arabia threatened to withhold funding for various aid programs. I guess the Obama administration, though, is finally heeding warnings from members of Congress, including Democratic Rep. Ted Lieu from California, that the U.S. is taking part in war crimes in Yemen by continuing to aid and arm the Saudi government, which is carrying out this war in Yemen. And as I mentioned earlier, not only are we providing these arms, we're providing these refueling missions for the jets that are dropping these bombs on Yemen, operations that have increased. We have increased the number of refueling missions we've run over that war theater since this whole mess started. And that's something that you're hearing Samantha Powers talk about at the UN. You know, have you no shame, Saudi Arabia or whoever else is conducting this pretty ghastly operation in Yemen. More dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you from Washington, D.C. Check out our website, districtsentinel.com. Bring you the latest news coming out of the White House, the executive agencies, Congress, and the courts. Some news breaking this afternoon outside of federal policy, sort of. Jury in South Carolina has found Dylan Roof guilty, massacring 9 people at an African-American church last year. Jury deliberated for 2 hours before finding Roof guilty of multiple charges, 33 charges, in fact, including murder, firearm offenses, religious obstruction crimes, and hate crimes. The sentencing phase of the trial is slated to begin next month. Roof is likely going to face the death penalty. You know, we can maybe close the book, at least on this pretty dark chapter over the last year. Turning from South Carolina to its neighbor in the north, North Carolina, back in October, a Republican office in North Carolina was firebombed. You might remember that. No one knows who did it or why, but as soon as it happened, Democrats, liberals, inexplicably started a fundraising campaign to actually raise money for the North Carolina Republican Party. The campaign, signal boosted by several prominent liberal journos, ended up scoring $13,000 for the already well-endowed North Carolina GOP. Now, those who donated to this GoFundMe, this campaign, likely didn't understand how that money would ultimately be used. It's not just to finance a new office that was firebombed, but also to finance retrograde policy that has become the MO of the North Carolina Republican Party. After that donation, the North Carolina GOP went on to deliver the state to Donald Trump during last month's presidential election. They also kept in place their supermajorities in the state legislature. They did lose the governorship, though. Outgoing Governor Pat McCrory tried as best as he could to stay in power despite collecting fewer votes. He had initially challenged the results. There were suggestions that the Republican state legislature in North Carolina might void the election and give it to the governor. Luckily, that didn't happen. Thankfully, that didn't happen. And although they did lose the governorship and they weren't able to pull off this sort of gubernatorial coup, the state Republican Party is making sure that the incoming Democratic governor can't do much to roll back the red tide. This week, Republican state legislatures held a special session in Raleigh, in which they proposed radical legislation, a series of bills to fundamentally change the balance of power between the legislature, which is controlled by Republicans now, and the governor's mansion, which is controlled by Democrats. We spoke earlier with journalist Paul Blest, who was on the ground in Raleigh, North Carolina, at the state capitol, following the events on the ground there. Paul's a staff writer at IndyWeek. You can follow him on Twitter at P. Blest. Here was our conversation. Okay, Paul, a lot has happened since the governor's race in North Carolina was called. McCrory eventually backed out. This week, it appears Republicans in the state legislature there have taken some extraordinary steps to make sure that the incoming Democratic governor is neutered. What exactly is happening this week in North Carolina in the state legislature?
Right. So they called a special session to pass a relief package for Hurricane Matthew victims and people who had their property destroyed by the wildfires in western North Carolina. And that passed yesterday. And there have been rumors over the past couple of weeks about what they might try to do. But, you know, nothing really was concrete until they passed that bill. And then about 10 minutes later, the Senate president announced on the floor that they were going to call another special session for later that day, and then they would open, you know, a filing period for bills. And then at the end of the day, it was around 7:45, the House filing period closed. There was about 25 bills that had been filed. Some are not going to go anywhere. Some are very small, but there's a bunch of big bills that are aimed at handcuffing the new governor. And the Republicans have supermajorities in both houses, and right now McCrory is still the governor. So, you know, they can pretty much do whatever they want.
If you're a Democrat, why would you not just say, go for it, and we'll reverse it when McCrory leaves? Obviously, that's a bit of a dumb question, but, you know, explain to people who, like myself, aren't that familiar with North Carolina politics.
Sorry. So Republicans have supermajorities in both houses of the state legislature, and in fact, these districts that they were elected into are unconstitutional, technically. There was a federal court decision that came down last year saying that these districts were unconstitutional, and they haven't redrawn the districts yet. So there was another decision made at the end of November that said, look, if you don't do this by March 15th, we're going to draw the districts for you. And there's going to be special elections in 2017. So the Republicans are really mad about that. In 2012, they actually lost the popular vote when it came to legislature seats, but they still kept a supermajority. That's how racially gerrymandered everything is.
Wow.
So the Republicans can do whatever they want without – they have a supermajority in the Senate by like 4 or 5 votes, supermajority in the House by about 5 votes. So really they can do whatever they want to Cooper, and he doesn't really have, you know, much of a chance of vetoing any of this. And since McCrory is still the governor, if this passes, he's probably going to let a lot of it go into law without his signature, which he can do. So really the governor is just kind of handcuffed as it is, and now they're just taking – I can run through the bills. So there was one bill that would require Senate confirmation of his cabinet appointments, which was never a thing before. So, you know, there's a couple of agencies like the Department of Environmental Quality that the Republicans are probably not going to back down from until he appoints like an oil executive or something like that. There is another position that the McCrory administration created called the Chief Information Officer, and they're taking that out of the cabinet and making an independent agency. And the governor won't appoint it, but the Republican lieutenant governor, who is a crazy culture warrior named Dan Forrest, is going to get to nominate the Chief Information Officer. And by the way, Forrest is probably going to run for governor in 2020. So this is probably going to happen a lot over the next couple of years. And then there's another regulatory reform bill. And there's one, you know, interesting thing about the regulatory reform bill is that there's a provision that makes it so storm drains are going to be deregulated a little bit. This is my understanding of the bill. And floods are going to happen more frequently. So this bill that they passed for flood relief victims yesterday, now they're going to pass, you know, if they pass this bill, then it's going to make it even worse the next time that there's floods in these areas, these very same areas. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that they're looking at right now. And because Cooper isn't the governor yet, and again, because they have supermajorities in both houses, there's really nothing the Democrats can do to stop them.
Is there any hope that these legislative moves might not withstand judicial review?
So this is another part of it. They are one of the things that was rumored to be happening would be court packing, because there are seven seats on the North Carolina Supreme Court, and then a Republican lost his seat. So now the Democrats control this by 4-3. They were rumored to be packing the seats and then letting McCrory appoint two new Supreme Court justices, so it'd be a 5-4 Republican split. They're not doing that, but they're reintroducing partisan Supreme Court races again. So, you know, it's going to be less likely the next time that a Democrat wins. Same thing for appeals processes. They're tightening the appeals process so less cases will go to the North Carolina Supreme Court. These things will probably end up in federal court, though. There was a case where McCrory actually went to court with the legislature, which is still controlled by Republicans, over a commission that they created that would have been a branch of the executive branch. And they were appointing members of it. And McCrory was like, I don't want that. So he went to court with them and he won. So there's a precedent there for Cooper to sue them. And he had a press conference earlier today where he said that, you know, if they try to exert any authority over him, then they're probably going to, I think his exact words was, I'll see you in court.
So what is the Republicans' justification for these new measures? I mean, we just had a Republican governor in McCrory who operated without any of these checks on his powers. Why do they need to come into place now?
Really, I mean, they've been pretty straightforward with what they're trying to do. Yesterday, there was a Republican legislator that said, you know, we were planning on doing this before, but now that there's a Democratic governor, we're going to do it a little bit more quickly. They're really just trying to consolidate their power. And it's really craven. And because of because they do have those supermajorities, there's really nothing anybody can do except organize. And there's a lot of people that have been protesting here today. And there's going to be another big protest at 4:30. The North Carolina NAACP, they've been doing more on Monday marches forever. And you know they're really, you know, nailing them on this. And I think honestly that's part of the reason that the Supreme Court packing didn't happen is because a lot of people organized around that and, you know, called their legislators and said, you know, if you do this,
That's Reverend Barber who's leading that stuff, right?
Yeah, Reverend Barber.
So you said that this happened on Wednesday. It was a special session to talk about or to pass relief for victims of Hurricane Matthew and wildfire stuff. Was there any indication that these other pieces of legislation were going to be brought up? Or was this just completely out of the blue?
There were rumors. There have been rumors since Cooper won the election, since it became clear that McCrory was going to concede that they might try to do this. And in McCrory's proclamation, so there's two ways that a special session could be called. One is if the governor calls it, and the other is if the lieutenant governor, who's technically the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House, requests 3/5 of the members from both chambers to approve it. And that's basically a supermajority. So Republicans all signed on to that except for, you know, a few exceptions. So they brought the second one back. McCrory called the first, but in McCrory's original proclamation, he left it pretty open-ended. So, you know, a lot of people thought that something might happen, but I talked to the Democratic Senate leader yesterday and right after they called the second special session, I mean, he said he had no indication that this was coming. He was talking to the Senate president and, you know, the Republican leadership, Republican colleagues, and they had no, he had no idea that this was coming. So he was ready to go home, according to him. And they just kind of dropped it on us. And the Speaker of the House actually lied yesterday and said that this is something that came up yesterday morning. They weren't really, like, planning on doing anything. And all the requests that they sent to legislators saying, hey, can you sign on to this petition for another special session, were all dated on Monday. So they've been collecting signatures since Monday. A couple of the signatures they got, the legislators weren't even here yesterday. So it was just a straight-up lie. And a lot of those things have been happening. So, they just dropped it on us at the last second.
The situation you've been describing with the, you know, the back room legislating, well, and, you know, until this week, this sort of seemingly backroom dealing, the court packing, the gerrymandering, everything else, it kind of, and, you know, if this is not an appropriate analogy, feel free to let me know, but it kind of sounds, the mentality behind this reminds me a little bit of the Wilmington insurrection of 1898. Is that completely inappropriate sort of analogy to make?
No, I don't think it is at all. In fact, the Democratic leader in the House, Larry Hall, yesterday brought that same point up. And I think it's a good analogy. I mean, you know, obviously there was physical violence back then, but as the Democratic leader said, you know, they're doing the exact same thing through legislative means. They're just, this is a coup in a lot of ways. And another thing to remember is that this is going to be, you know, something that North Carolina and Wisconsin are going to be blueprints for Congress and Donald Trump. So a lot of the things that are happening now in North Carolina are going to be repeated at the federal level. So this is kind of a, you know, a sneak preview of what the next 4 years are going to look like, in my opinion.
And last time we had you on the show, Paul, we talked about this as well. Might as well bring it up again now that we're seeing how the North Carolina GOP is operating. Important to remember that this sort of stuff would be going on if Donald Trump didn't win or if he didn't run at all, that these are some of the extreme views of the North Carolina Republican Party, regardless of Trump coming on the stage, which makes that whole fundraiser for the North Carolina GOP a few months ago that a lot of liberals online supported and donated to, it makes it all a bit more ridiculous in retrospect.
It does, yeah. I get madder and madder every day at those people. And most of those people came from, you know, New York and Silicon Valley, where none of this, you know, obviously New York isn't the most transparent state, but, you know, they don't live in a place where Republicans have the ability to ruin lives the way they have in North Carolina. I mean, Medicare expansion is literally, or the lack of the expansion of Medicare has literally killed people. You know, they've attacked unemployment insurance. They've attacked labor, the environment. It's really, I mean, McCrory, you know, Trump praised McCrory a couple of, you know, weeks ago when McCrory was in contention for a cabinet position. He said, you know, McCrory brought fracking to North Carolina. So all of these things, you know, are terrible. And, you know, they will say, the Democrats that supported that will say, like, yeah, I disagree with them. But, you know, this is what happens when Republicans get into power. They use that power. When Democrats get into power, it's exactly what happened in 2008, 2009, 2010. They try to compromise their way out of everything. This is what, I mean, this is the face of Republican governance. I mean, they make no secrets about what they're going to do.
Yeah.
So if the Democrats, you know, really want to donate to something, they should donate to organizations that are organizing around this. You know, if they should donate to House candidates and Senate candidates that are going to be running in 2017 and 2018. They should not be donating to the Republican Party.
Yeah, the Moral Mondays is a good thing to get involved with, not a Indiegogo or GoFundMe
well,
for it.
Well, of course, that fundraiser was in response to an alleged firebombing. You know, but that said, you know, sometimes stuff happens and no need to give money to the Republican Party ever.
Yeah, and these are also, I mean, it's suspected that anarchists did this because the Orange County Democratic Party, which is the same county that the Republican Party headquarters was firebombed in, they also had graffiti scratched on the wall and stuff like that. But, you know, Trump blamed the Democrats for that, and the North Carolina Republican Party blamed the Democrats for that. They're really just playing on two different planes. Republicans are playing to win, and Democrats are living in this, like, you know, West Wing fantasy where having no decency, sir, actually works. And it doesn't in North Carolina. I can tell you that for a fact.
That's Paul Blessed, a staff writer at Indy Week, reporting from the state capitol in Raleigh, North Carolina, where Republicans are going low and Democrats will most certainly go high.
And lose.
Yeah. Follow Paul on Twitter at PBlessed. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Paul.
More dissent coming up. Unanimous dissent still here with you. Still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
A shoeless Sam Knight,
I should
add.
For the second day in a row, baby.
This is becoming a new thing here, unfortunately. Although it's not nearly as pungent as I expected it would be.
Wait till the end of winter and these boots get some miles on them.
Sam's rocking his new winter boots here that he can't keep on for all day long. He's got to give himself a break during the radio show here.
To paraphrase King Lear, my good dude, reason not the need. I don't need to take off my shoes. I just want to, okay?
Fair enough.
And I got to say, you know, maybe if you were a little less self-conscious and lived your life to the fullest, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe you could take some lessons from my free-spirited ways right now.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
Noted. I'll take that up with my therapist next week.
Anyway, sorry.
Let's not get into it.
Let's not get into it.
In case I haven't reminded our listeners in the last 15 minutes, check out our website. It's districtsentinel.com. Lots of good news stories over there.
It's good. One story that you won't see over at districtsentinel.com is Hillary man Al Giordano just endorsed Tom Perez for DNC chair.
Huge surprise there.
Yeah, huge surprise there. Huge surprise.
Somebody needs to ask Tom Perez exactly why he's running.
I don't know, because the White House asked him to, probably.
We've got Keith Ellison, who's gotten endorsements from across the spectrum on the left.
Yeah.
From leadership and from the left wing of the party. A guy who's got the momentum, and yet here comes Tom Perez. I'd like Tom Perez to explain why he hasn't endorsed Keith Ellison, why he's running against Keith Ellison. Maybe we'll get an answer to that question. This process unfolds.
There's a really bizarre strand of thinking among Democrats that the Bernie wing doesn't deserve any say because Bernie himself is not a Democrat. It's like very tribal. I don't know.
No, I think it's a knee-jerk reaction by the Democratic Party to neutralize its left flank. I mean, that is the main purpose of the Democratic establishment for as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
It cost him the election this year.
It seems like to me the why, like the more superficial why, is probably because the White House was asking Perez to run.
Yeah, that's why he ran, although I'm sure he won't admit to that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe we can talk about this more at the end of the show if there's time. But for now, it turns out that one of Trump's cabinet picks has a lot in common with her probably soon-to-be new boss, unless the Senate rejects her nomination. Betsy DeVos, Donald's pick to be the next Secretary of Education, was also born with a silver spoon in her mouth, and she also apparently doesn't think that rules apply to her, at least some of the rules. DeVos funded partially and helped run political action committees that were fined $5.3 million in 2006 by election regulators in Ohio, and she still hasn't paid the penalties, which were affirmed by a judge in 2013. Actually, I think they were a little less than $5.3 million because when the judge affirmed the penalties, gosh, I don't know the gender of the judge, so I don't want to say she, let's just assume she's a she. She ordered the PACs here to pay late fees too. So,
I mean, anyone who remembers the days of Blockbuster would know if you had a videotape
for
2 days too long, you were going to start being hounded to pay your fines.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be allowed to rent another tape from Blockbuster until you did pay those fines.
If you're 31 days late on your insurance payments, you'll get your coverage canceled.
Exactly. Or if your credit card payments, if you're late on that, you'll be written up in the credit report. But apparently you can just not pay a $5.3 million fine.
If you're Betsy DeVos, apparently this is the case. Five Democratic caucus senators noted this on Wednesday in a letter to DeVos herself, asking her to do what average Americans are forced to do when they are assessed with massive penalties by government agencies. Cough up the damn money. Rather than pay the fines for violating the law, the All Children Matter PAC simply seized operations and never paid the significant sum it owed the state of Ohio. That's what the senators said in their letter.
By the way, this All Children Matter PAC, I just am sure it's up to no good with a name like that.
But maybe not in the context of like All Lives Matter.
It was education, right?
It was founded in 2006. It's just because when I heard All Children Matter, I just thought of, oh, God. But then, you know, it was founded in 2006.
No, it's All Children Matter so that they should all have to pay extravagant amounts of money for private school.
We'll get there.
Sorry,
of course, this was
here. I'm jumping the gun.
This was during George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind. I don't know. Maybe they were trying to play on words there.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a sec about the privatization stuff. The letter was signed by Tom Udall, Sherrod Brown, Jeff Merkley, Ed Markey, and Bernie Sanders. Hence the Democratic caucus, as I noted at the top of the segment, block or whatever. Bernie's not an official Democrat. He's not a Democrat at all. Well, not at all. He caucuses with the Democrats. Here I am getting all neurotic again.
We get it.
Anyway, moving on. DeVos has for years been involved in right-wing education activism, funding initiatives that push quote-unquote school choice and vouchers, with a particular concern for helping Christian fundamentalist education. Hence, my colleague Sam here correctly calling DeVos an education privatizer. She was born to industrialist Edgar Prince, who also fathered Eric Prince of Blackwater fame. So her family spawned the 21st century's most infamous mercenary, too.
Interesting. I did not know that.
More on DeVos's illustrious family ties. Her father-in-law was Richard DeVos Sr., who the New York Times described as, quote, the co-founder of Amway, a company built on multi-level marketing, or what critics call pyramid selling. So, yeah, she married into pyramid money.
Look, I've been in Amway for a decade. It's sooner or later going to make me rich over here. I'll talk to you about it after the show. I've got a pitch for you.
Some good literature for me?
Yeah.
Sounds like a pretty great investment.
It is.
We'll discuss that later. DeVos Sr. had also been throwing money at Christian fundamentalist education causes since the 1970s. And the same New York Times article that I just read from noted that in 2002, DeVos Jr. spoke to the Heritage Foundation about his family's assault on public education, saying, quote, we need to be cautious about talking too much about these activities. So vouchers, choice are a lot nicer words than public school privatization, which is really what these guys are about.
And guys and girls. And heading the Department of Education will give them a lot of influence.
If you will. An update now on the incoming administration's posture toward China, something we've talked about a few times on the show in the past few weeks. Trump, of course, made waves after the election when he accepted a congratulatory phone call from Taiwan's president, and then again made waves when he questioned the wisdom of One China, the policy that has, since the 70s, seen the U.S. recognize the People's Republic as the only legitimate government of China. Taiwan, of course, is where nationalist forces fled after losing to communists led by Mao Zedong in 1949. It is regarded as a renegade province by Beijing. Thus, the People's Republic has been largely unimpressed with Trump's statements on Taiwan and One China. And now elements within the Chinese Communist Party are vocalizing extreme displeasure that reveal just how quickly things can escalate. The Global Times, a state-run tabloid, put out an editorial on Wednesday floating the idea of China invading Taiwan. Time will tell after Trump's team takes over the U.S. whether it will willfully utilize the One China policy as leverage, the column stated. In any case, the current farce has made China vigilant. It might be time for the Chinese mainland to reformulate its Taiwan policy, the editorial continued, make the use of force as a main option, and carefully prepare for it.
He's not even sworn in yet.
Yeah, not even sworn in yet. Global Times added, once Taiwan independence forces violate the anti-secession law, the Chinese mainland can in no time punish them militarily. So, scary stuff. The commentary was delivered the day before the Chinese military hit back at think tank report that accused it of building new military installations on island outcrops in the South China Sea in disputed territory. China's Ministry of Defense said Thursday, quote, "As for necessary military installations, they are mainly for defense and self-protection and are legitimate and lawful. If someone makes a show of force at your front door, would you not ready your slingshot?" I don't know. I might just try to like go into the panic room, but then again, I don't know. I'm not the...
Plus, if you're talking to Americans here, slingshot is not the right tool we use over here.
Yeah, pal. We have the Second Amendment. Got some firearms.
We got about 300 million guns in this country.
Beijing was responding to findings put out by a Washington-based organization called the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative. The group had said Wednesday that satellite imagery showed China building weapons systems in the Spratly Islands. Reminder again that during the presidential campaign, Trump criticized Hillary for being too enthusiastic about military confrontation, saying her policy in Syria would lead to, quote, World War III. I mean, that might not have been wrong, but I don't think World War III is what Trump was concerned about here.
No.
He wanted people to vote for him. Anyway, moving on. Time now for some economic news for the 99%.
Wall Street! Wall Street! Wall Street! Wall Street! Wall Street! Wall Street!
I got to tell you, I think I had just the right amount of coffee today.
Really?
I've been doing
updates. Somewhere in between 4 cups and 9 cups.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not really feeling the mid-block fatigue, you know? You know how it gets when you, like, read a bunch of stuff and you're like, oh, man, got to read a bunch more stuff? Not feeling it. So let's continue. As we noted on our last show, the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates on Wednesday by 0.25 percentage point. The federal funds rate, a key determinant of the cost of borrowing and lending on wholesale markets, is now set to fall between 0.5 and 0.75%. It was the second increase since last December, and it was the first time since the Great Recession, the last hike, that the federal funds range was above zero. Zero was the lower bound for years throughout the Great Recession. Last December, it was raised, and that itself was the first increase since 2006. So it's exciting times for monetary policy watchers. Exciting times indeed. Possibly a golden age that will never end. Anyway, after the Fed hiked the rate, that sparked some movement in money markets. The price of short-term treasury bonds plunged. Yields of T-bills that mature in 2 years jumped to their highest level since August 2009. Bond yields equal payouts divided by price. So when yields rise, either issuers are trying to do more to attract more demand, or investors or are fleeing on their own. Meanwhile, treasury bonds that you can cash out in 10 years, their yields hit a high not seen since September 2014. According to the Wall Street Journal, the move away from bonds is due to an improved economic outlook. Money capital is moving from bond market to the stock market. Investors had fled to government bonds, the journal stated, over the past few years, anticipating low growth and low inflation. But now that Republicans are back in power, meaning that, guess what, deficit spending is actually good, there are higher expectations for economic growth and inflation, as seen in recent stock market gains. Speaking of which, Wednesday's interest rate hike saw the U.S. dollar appreciate in value on foreign exchange markets, something that will make making America great again much more difficult if Trump was hoping to close the trade deficit. The dollar ended the trading day yesterday after the hike close to its highest level in 14 years. That's according to the value of the greenback against a basket of currencies. That in turn saw the price of oil fall after a sustained increase brought about by an OPEC agreement on production levels. The price of oil on global markets as of recording is about $54 per barrel, down from almost $56 on Tuesday. At the end of last month, at the end of November, oil was trading globally at about $46.50 per barrel. So it went up about $10, down a few bucks after the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates.
I feel like I just ate a giant bowl of broccoli.
You know, it's funny that you say that because, well, when I was majoring in econ in college, I would routinely describe my readings as trying to drink milk if you're lactose intolerant.
Well, I hope our investor listeners glean some important information for their strategy there.
This isn't homeowners and investors, man. Like, if you're going, if you got to fill up your car.
Okay, I don't.
Okay. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, like I said, I'm sure our listeners do.
Look.
I own nothing.
You own nothing. Do you owe anything?
Yes.
Okay, well.
I owe a little bit.
Now refinancing your debt is probably going to be a little more expensive if you needed to do that. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have debt.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm sure they do too.
But yeah, you're right. There's a lot of numbers and it's broccoli. Anyway, some news on the telecoms regulatory front. This is a little more sexy. So,
Tom Wheeler.
Yeah, Tom Wheeler. FCC Chair Tom Wheeler is stepping down. He had previously refused to commit to leaving the position when President Obama's second term is up, but now he has. He has done that. Politico also noted his exit means the Trump admin will take office with a 2-1 Republican majority on the FCC, quote, allowing the GOP to immediately begin dismantling Obama-era regulations. So if we were hoping that the Democratic Party would engage in obstructionism to thwart Trump, to pay back Republicans, and to just advance the interests of their constituency, Wheeler didn't get the memo, or they're just not putting up a fight in this regard. But I really wish they would.
Yeah.
If we're going to, you know, encourage GOP Mitch McConnell style obstructionism, got to do it at every level, you know? Anyway.
Yes, especially to protect things like net neutrality.
Yes, indeed. Yes, more stringent rules on net neutrality were passed in early 2015 by Wheeler's FCC, and now they are very much under threat. Wheeler was a lobbyist before taking over as FCC commissioner in 2013, but he surprised a lot of public interest groups by governing further to the left than his CV had indicated he would. The trade groups he once represented have been among the fiercest opponents of his policies, including net neutrality, Politico also said on Thursday. On a personal note, my favorite of these policies were definitely Wheeler's efforts to give municipal broadband a boost by preempting state levels that stopped city governments from expanding their service. That was sadly struck down by federal appellate judges in the weeks before the election. Finally, one more bit of news to get through in this year, People's Bulletin. Democratic senators introduced legislation on Thursday that seeks to put an end once and for all to the Trump conflict of interest debate. Liz Warren, Ben Cardin, Chris Coons, Dick Durbin, and Jeff Merkley put forth the bill. According to a press release issued by Warren's staff, the proposal, quote, would require the president and vice president to disclose and divest any potential financial conflicts of interest. Warren's staff added, quote, it would also require presidential appointees to recuse themselves from any specific matters involving the president's financial conflicts of interest that come before their agencies. I have to say, when I first saw this bill, I thought it probably had no chance of making it anywhere. But Republicans, they might be getting a little nervous about how Trump's presidency will impact their legacy in the long term. And supporting this could be a nice little CYA safeguard for them.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe. Speaking of Elizabeth Warren and the long view, the lawmaker revealed on Wednesday that she will be serving in the next Congress on the Senate Armed Services Committee. This sparked immediate reaction on Twitter by me, speculating that Warren is going to run for president in 2020.
That's probably good speculation.
Happy to elaborate later, but I think we're running out of time here.
Yeah, real quick, as I was walking into the studio, I saw this number. Trump has named 17 people to his cabinet so far with a combined wealth of $9.5 billion. That's more wealth than the 43 million least wealthy American households combined. About one-third of the nation's household, 17 members of Trump's cabinet, is richer than.
That's awful.
That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. On that note, you can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. Stick around for tomorrow's show. We're throwing someone in the garbage can.
Yeah.
Until then, we're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.